Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, your dog probably, if you have one, loves water. But you need to be very cautious about where your dog swims. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk back with us, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She comes by every month to talk with us. And she has some warnings about the risk of exposing your dog to contaminated water. We'll also talk about sugar substitutes and the harm they may cause your pet. So we'll deal with other things as well. If you have another pet health question, give a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is nice to be here, Larry.
Well, we've got blue-green algae in the news.
Yeah. Everywhere, what? Including here in Madison.
Yes.
Yeah. We had set a dog in recently that survived. And it's one of these problems that at this time of the year, when water's been standing and this hot weather, probably the two big things that we run into troubles with are this algae toxin called blue-green algae, or leptospirosis, which is a bacteria that can also severely affect dogs as well as people too.
Yes.
And even blue-green algae is a toxin for people too. So this is not only for pet information, but human information. And so if you're questioning where your dog is swimming, and this is the big issue with these algae overgrowths, is even though we're thinking it has to be blue-green, it can be brown, it can be red, so there's different colors. It may sink, and you may not even see it. It may be kind of a sludge on the bottom, and you just may smell it as not being very pleasant. But those are the kind of things that attract dogs, and all they have to do is to have a couple of laps of this water, and they can potentially get this toxin. You don't know if the toxin's there until the water's tested. And so often it's too late. We don't even recognize it, because then public health gets in and starts doing some testing and puts up signs. Meanwhile, you've already had your pet in the water. So if you suspect that your pet has been in contaminated water and are showing the two kind of groupings of symptoms that we see with blue-green algae are either neurologic or liver. There's two kinds of toxins. In the neurologic form, they're usually staggering around, start having tremors, seizuring, and then leading to death. In the liver form, the liver is so important for so many things in the body that we can see everything from, turning jaundice to losing blood clotting factors and starting to have bleeding disorders also leading to neurologic signs. And so often when these cases are diagnosed, if they're not receiving veterinary care kind of round the clock, really critical care management, they will not make it. So, avoid areas where you're unsure of the water quality. And this even includes kind of standing water in backyard ponds. I have two small ponds in my backyard, and my dogs don't go in them because they don't know how to swim very well. And even though they're not very deep, I'd prefer them not to. But those would be areas that sometimes we forget about, that they're right there in our own yard that the dog could be exposed to. And then the other bug that we see is a bacteria that you may not even know it's there. And it doesn't even take standing water. It can be in mud and moist soil as well. And this is this bacteria called leptospirosis. It's spread through the urine of infected animals. And those infected animals could be other dogs, rats, raccoons, stray cats, although
beavers.
It's unlikely. deer, anything that's out there could potentially be spreading this. And unfortunately, this is a disease that people can get as well. It is considered zoonotic. And we do have vaccines available for leptospirosis for dogs. It only protects for four types of lepto, and there are many more forms out there. It's just the four most prevalent forms that we see. And dogs that get exposed to this often have either liver or kidney issues. And we just had a dog in recently that had to spend a few days in critical care and in our isolation critical care area because it required round-the-clock therapy. It was not vaccinated for lepto and probably inadvertently at a dog park, out for a walk, drinking from a puddle, went through some mud, licked their feet, somehow happened, got exposed to this bug and had to go through treatment. But it too survived. It's one of those things where, you know, if you're suspicious of it, you have to start, we usually start treating right away. It is responsive to very commonly used antibiotics, but it's mainly supportive care while your dog is fighting off this infection. So if your dog's at risk, which is just about anybody that lives in this area of Wisconsin, where we've got all these lakes and rivers and standing water with all the rain we've been having, get your dog vaccinated for leptospirosis unless there's some medical reason why they can't receive it.
Well, in other news that's not the best in the world, the sweetener xylitol.
Oh my goodness!
Is found in many food items, but toxic to some animals.
Oh my goodness! This is something that the FDA every once in a while puts out a new updated listing and warning, and they just did this last month, and I was shocked to see how many different products contain this sugar-free sweetener. We used to think it was mainly gums and mints and things because it does have some kind of anti-cavity effects. It helps with dry mouth, and so it's used a lot in some of those types of products. But there are over 700 products on the market now, including things like different hand creams and cosmetics that you may leave on your bathroom counter and have your dog get exposed to. This is only a dog problem, not a cat problem. But what happens in dogs is a very low dose of xylitol. It takes very little of this particular ingredient. Will cause the dog to develop hypoglycemia. It causes massive insulin release and their blood sugar drops to critical levels where they can become so hypoglycemic that they may seizure and die. At higher doses, it can put the dog into liver failure, and there is no treatment for this. There is no antidote. This is just supportive care while your dog's body is trying to heal from exposure.
Even in clothing.
Some clothing that have like coolant factors and things worked into it. The thing that was a shocker to me are some of the jams, peanut butters, nut butters, things that you may pull out to give your dog its medication. I mean, I use peanut butter to give my dog its medication. Even some of the sugar-free ice creams that are out there. And how many people let their dog lick the ice cream dish?
Yeah.
I found a fact that was like really shocking. They make xylitol in a baking like mix, like a sugar form type thing where it's a sugar substitute. One cup of that xylitol baking mix, the sweetener, can cause hypoglycemia in death in, get this, 70 dogs that weigh 60 pounds. Ah. So you can do the math, 140 dogs at 30 pounds or whatever. But that is how toxic this is. I don't even know. I mean, divide 70 into one cup. How many teaspoons is that? I'd have to do all the math, but it's a very tiny amount. And so people may have this ingredient sitting in their pantry. And I know I've had dogs that have learned how to get into my revolving shelves in the corner cabinets. And I've had to put child locks on them because all it takes is a rear end bumping it and they have their way with noodles and whatever happens to be down there. And you have some of these things, that could potentially be a problem. But I do recommend that you look at this list that the FDA has come out with. There is other ways of reporting products if you happen to find it. Companies are often not required to put the amount of xylitol on their products list. It's often a proprietary thing that they want to keep secret. And so it's difficult to know how much your dog is actually ingested. There was just recently a veterinarian, and she detailed how much effort she had to go through with contacting company to find out how much xylitol was in some gum that it was an oddball brand that this dog ingested, and they just didn't want to release that information. And it was, you know, meanwhile, minutes are ticking by and you don't know. And the typical antidotes that we use for toxins like activated charcoal doesn't work for this as well. So the best thing you can do is just don't have it in your house and know what you're bringing in. Keep things away from your dog. And if you are suspicious that your dog ate anything, don't waste your time calling poison control. get them to an emergency clinic or to your veterinarian for immediate care so they can get them on a glucose strip.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us a question or maybe a photo of your pet, too. We love that. At ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Randy in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hi. I was wondering what the normal blood pressure is of an adult cat.
The normal blood pressure in a cat, there's a little bit of a variability because of often the white coat syndrome. Very few people check cats' blood pressure at home. But if you were to do it when the cat is comfortable and relaxed, we usually just get the systolic blood pressure when we're measuring blood pressure in cats. And it's typically about 120, exactly what it is in people. Where we start worrying about it, though, is when we start seeing it above 140. We kind of give that little buffer to say, hey, you're a little upset in the clinic. And then, you know, so above 140 is considered questionable. Above 160 is real. And that cat is hypertensive and is at risk of having organ issues. Like often we'll see acute onset blindness when cats have retinal bleeds due to hypertension. So it is something that we often monitor in cats. Not usually young, healthy cats without any other clinical diseases, but the kitties that we worry about are usually our older cats that have kidney disease. This is something that we'll often see cats developing hypertension with kidney disease, and then sometimes cats that are hyperthyroid. Usually we can control their blood pressure once we get their thyroid level back down to normal levels. But is there something that your cat has had issues with that's required to have its blood pressure checked?
Well, he's been on amlodipine for a while. And it's kind of funny because I looked on the internet and they said, you know, anything below 160 is okay. But he's been on this amlodipine for a while. And he's also taken another drug too because his kidney readings were a little bit high on some of those things, but they since have come down to normal levels.
Good,
but,
good.
His blood pressure. I'm bringing him in next week for a total analysis for his blood pressure and the kidney thing. He's due for that for next Friday, and. But the blood pressure that was reading at that time has been always around 160.
So. I'd be aiming, if your cat's relaxed and comfortable, I'd be looking at trying to get that blood pressure a little bit lower. And it's very common for cats to need more than one antihypertensive agent. So often we'll start with amlodipine and then add in another class of drugs. Like there's usually another drug called benazepril that we'll add in. Sometimes we'll raise the dose. We'll start with a lower dose of the drug that you're currently on and go up to double that dose. So we play with the drugs a little bit, rechecking again a couple of weeks later. What we do too to make sure that we're getting accurate readings is we always keep a little log in the record as to what size cuff we use. We use little itty bitty tiny cuffs, as you've probably seen, and then what leg we use it on, because sometimes there can be some variability between left and right and front and back, and so that way we get an accurate reading for the cat at every visit with the same cuff size and the same leg. Often the same operator really helps as well, and so having the same technician do it if the cat's used to having that done. And we like to do it in the room with the owner after the cat has had a chance to come in and just spend 10 or 15 minutes in kind of a dog-free zone where the cat can be comfortable and relaxed. And that way we get the most accurate readings that we can.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jane Rotunda, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. Open lines at 800-642-1234 or email us your question or maybe your photo of your pet at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Shelley in Madison next. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, thank you very much. And Dr. Sarchuk, we are so lucky to have you. You are like a treasure to those of us in Wisconsin. I'm calling to ask about my dog's seasonal allergies. Last year, he's not 3 years old yet, big dog, 105 pounds. The vet says they take better care of him than most people do children. But he gets, like last year, he had like stuffed up ears that at this time of the year, and he had to have medication. This year, he started itching again. As soon as he got medication, it stopped. I'm wondering if there is any alternative to address those seasonal allergies other than medicine when it comes on. And again, it seems to be now. My doctor thinks it's probably related to ragweed pollen that's at this time of the year.
You are right. This is like the worst time of the year. Every other patient I'm seeing is coming in with itching, scratching, secondary skin infections. These appointments take forever because there's so much to discuss to be able to deal with these. So there's three main causes of itch for dogs. And I think the big things that you can do to help your dog is we know that external parasites add to the itch. So making sure that your dog is on year-round flea and tick control. Treating secondary infections, and that means that your veterinarian is going to have to look under the microscope to see what's involved to cause the dog to have irritated skin. I just had a dog in yesterday where the year before the dog had a yeast infection on its feet, and that's what was causing all the itching. This year, same symptoms, but the dog probably has a generalized staph infection now. So we need to address it differently than what we would do when we're dealing with a fungal infection versus a bacterial infection. So sometimes and we use a lot of combination products to be able to treat those, but we do have to sometimes address it a little bit differently. So we like to look for what's causing these secondary infections and things that you can do to help prevent them. And this also helps with dealing with the contact allergens and things, is routine bathing. We usually say twice a week with a medicated shampoo that's going to keep yeast and bacteria at a dull roar. So that's usually a miconazole, chlorhexidine-based shampoo. Some of these are available over the counter, but you're usually looking at getting them from your veterinarian. And between when those days that you can't bathe, treating topically with the same type of thing. And these are available in sprays and mousses and things. And depending on the area that the body needs to be treated, the product may vary. For ears, we often use drops that have a steroid in it. For feet and bellies and things, a spray or a mousse may be more effective. But that's going to help keep that infection under control. We don't usually have to treat with systemic antibiotics if you can be really aggressive going topically. Then we get into directed allergy therapy, and that's where people like to try to pull out antihistamines, but they rarely work well in dogs. You can try them, but again, it barely puts a dent in the dog's itch. We're usually looking at using medications like the newer ones, one called Apoquil. That's a tablet that's given daily after an initial loading period for a couple of weeks. And then there's another injectable drug called Cytopoint, which is an immune therapy for treating dogs with allergies. Also look into getting your dog allergy tested. Your dog is a young enough dog. It takes a year or more for once you have a dog allergy tested to find out what they're allergic to desensitize them to those things that are part of the allergy cocktail. And although in the past we used to have owners learn to give injections of the allergen solution, there's now sublingual therapy available where it's a liquid that is put in their mouth a couple of times a day. And so it's easy. Dogs tolerate it really well, and it works just as well as the allergy injections, and yet it's easier for you to be able to do at home. So I really strongly suggest if you've got a dog that you're seeing the season getting longer or itching's getting worse, which is what it sounds like, and your dog went from ears to ears and feet now, every year it's going to continue to get worse, and your dog may become allergic to more and more things. This is the time to start trying to see if you can desensitize your dog to what they're allergic to.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Shelley. Just to go to our emails, Russ in Exonia had a similar question. 55-pound, 7-year-old English Shepherd, allergies in late summer, hind paws look red and irritated. He's been giving the dog 25 milligrams of diphenhydramine.
Mm-hmm.
but relief is limited, wondering if he can safely give two pills instead of one.
Probably still would do nothing. Like I said, antihistamines, dogs have other allergy mediators than histamine. And so when we give antihistamines to the dog, it may make them a little dopey, so they're not itching quite as much. But I really think if you've got a dog that's continuing to itch, it's time to go in and have that skin cytology looked at so it can be treated appropriately with the right combination of things, and then a more directed therapy. In the past, we used to have to use steroids, which had their whole host of side effects, or we'd use sometimes a steroid antihistamine combination, called Temeral P was a very commonly used drug. But we've got other things now that are very safe, not that inexpensive, I have to admit, but helpful for the dog. I have a dog right now who has seasonal allergies, and Stanley is on Apoquel, and it has literally made my life so much better because I sleep. He's not up at night licking his feet, and I'm not nudging him and saying, quit licking, you know, and we all sleep through the night, and his feet are staying healthy, and we have a better relationship because of it.
Okay, there you go. Joan in Wood County has something different to talk about. Let's go there. Hi, Joan.
Yeah, thanks. I've got a dog that was, or a 15-year-old dog. She's in good shape. We've been watching a colonic mass, and just through the imaging, it was noticed that it was progressively larger than the last time it was imaged about 2-3 months ago. And I'm just wondering what the risks are for removal of that part of the colon. What are the real risks?
Yeah. Well, I mean, anytime we're talking about a surgical procedure, we're talking about anesthesia. So we need to know the health status of your dog to make sure that cardiovascularly they're okay, that our organs are functioning fine. And we anesthetize dogs with other disease entities going on at the same time, as long as we're aware of what we're dealing with, so that we can manage blood pressure and fluids and levels and so on. They can get through procedures very safely. And then depending on where this mass is located, depending on how much of the colon needs to be resected, obviously the colon is a very important part of the body for holding fecal material. And if this is located near any of the nerves that are involved with continence, you may have an incontinent dog. If you are dealing, with a mass that's up, higher, it may not involve having any incontinence, but there always is the risk when you're dealing with that area of wound dehiscence and things, because the gut back there is, obviously full of bacteria. So we, need to, there's certain surgical techniques where they put in super duper stitches to be able to keep everything from leaking out. I am not a surgeon. I avoid gut surgery by all costs, even when I did do surgery, because it is a more high risk surgery to do because of the specialized techniques and so on to prevent contamination of the body cavity. But a surgeon that is experienced with doing GI surgery and your dog is a healthy surgical candidate, I'd say go for it if it's going to provide your dog with better quality of life and there's no indication of infiltration in regional lymph nodes or anything like that.
Good luck, Joan. Thank you so much for calling. I want to give Arwen in Eau Claire a chance to join in. Hi, Arwen.
Hello, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. This might be a weird question, but there's a 13-year-old cat my mother-in-law has, and he's he howls like this real guttural, like he's lost, and then you say his name, and he kind of comes into the room and stops, but it's like this repeating, like, issue.
Yeah.
And we can't figure out if he's like, he's healthy. He's been to the vet, and I mean, he's in a good home. We can't figure out if that's age. He's 13. Is that a kitty dementia thing? Lost?
Yeah, there's probably three things that I see that cause cats to not have that auto inhibition and meow or howl louder. One of them is what you just described, having a cat that has some a cognitive decline. These are cats that may stop using the litter box, may have changes in their sleep-wake cycle and be wandering around, getting lost in areas. You find them stuck in rooms that they may not normally go in. You know, just not being aware of their surroundings, kind of changes in their social interactions. And there are a few things that we can do with supplements and diets and things that may be able to help some of these cats. And, you know, so that would be something to consider. I have seen cats that are hearing impaired also lose that auto feedback regarding how loud they're meowing. And again, because they're not hearing things in the environment, they get lost. And so until they see somebody or feel a vibration and get reoriented, you may see them howling as well. And then lastly, hyperthyroidism. And I know you said that you have taken your cat to the veterinarian, but this is something that often has to be diagnosed on a blood test. And so a 13-year-old cat having a little blood work done, making sure a head-to-toe physical is done, because many times cats that have a thyroid nodule, the veterinarian may be able to feel it. It sits right on the main airway, the trachea, and can be about the size of a lentil. So they're not big, and they kind of slip under your finger when you're palpating that area. And sometimes we will see other physical changes that point us in that direction, things like a rapid heart rate, a heart murmur, some weight loss that may not be that subtle to it may be very subtle to you, but even a few ounces in a cat can be significant. So time to go back to your veterinarian again so that maybe you can get some of these things evaluated so that you can have a little peace around your house.
Or around mom's house.
Yes, yeah.
Arwin, thank you so much. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Well, you can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Julie in Two Rivers next. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I have a question it's a behavioral question.
Mm-hmm.
We have a 14-week-old German Shepherd puppy who I am head over heels in love with. Adorable.
Good.
But she is an ankle biter.
Oh, boy.
And not just an ankle. You know, she gets so excited and revved up, but lots of energy, but likes to bite. And I've gotten just so many different ideas about how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping for some recommendations from you.
Well, probably the top three things are redirect. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, every time your dog is, you know, starts getting into that I'm going to be biting you mode, you have something in your pocket that you can substitute so they know what the appropriate things are for chewing. And this would even, you know, work for dogs that are going after furniture or electrical cords or anything that could potentially damage your house or even be a major health risk to them. Don't punish your puppy, because sometimes what that will end up doing is creating a dog that learns to nip defensively. And so closing their mouth, you know, people will grab their mouth and say, don't bite. That often winds them up even more because it's part of the game. I bite you, then you hold my mouth shut and are kind of biting me with your hand, and then I bite you back, and it becomes this vicious cycle. Sometimes making a loud sound like an injured puppy, like making a type sound, where of course that wasn't very loud, but I'd make much louder than that to get that millisecond startle response, so that as soon as that puppy's teeth let go, where they go, oh, I hurt you, you've got something that you can put in their mouth. And maybe after 50, 80, 100 times, the puppy will finally go, oh, don't bite people. I'm supposed to chew on this stuff. And also teach your dog how you want them to greet you, because if they're jumping on you and nipping you, again, you're pushing them down. You're not giving them, you're telling them what not to do, but how you want them to greet you, which may be sitting. And there are, you know, puppy training classes. That's a perfect place to go to start learning some of those ways of getting your dog to come to you and sit, and then you greet your dog, and that way you're able to give your dog something else rather than your ankle as a way of play and entertainment. So I hope that works for you. They usually outgrow this as well, but
yeah,
you can make it worse, so be careful.
Patricia McConnell calls a puppy a mouth with paws.
There you go. Perfect. Yeah.
That's what they've got, that mouth going all the time. Good luck. Thank you so much, Julie, for calling. Terry in Heartland, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon, whichever. I have a question with regards to epilepsy in a dog. How is that formally diagnosed?
That's a very good question, because it often depends on the breed, the age that it started, the number of seizures the dog had, the length of seizures, whether they're coming in clusters or not. So, you know, normally if we have a dog that's having more than six seizures a year, or they're anywhere, you know, they're coming in clusters, meaning a couple of them in a day, that would warrant that we better jump in and start, you know, getting this dog on treatment. But regardless, whether, you know, when we have a dog have its first seizure, my standard workup would be getting some blood work done, because we want to make sure that there's nothing outside of the brain that could potentially be causing the dog to have a seizure, like liver disease, you know, undetected chronic severe kidney disease. That's usually like end-stage kidney disease, low blood sugar. There's a number of things like that that we would want to rule out. Depending on the age of the dog and how often the seizures are occurring and what we're finding on our neurologic exam, if we're finding any abnormalities, that may warrant a more thorough evaluation by having some imaging done. And again, we're looking at probably getting an MRI of the brain done. If it's an older dog, we typically take chest rads and do an abdominal ultrasound to look for cancer other places if we're thinking there may be a brain tumor. But we'd be looking for something that may be able to be surgically corrected. And sometimes brain tumors can be surgically resected, especially if they're involving the meninges or the coating of the brain. Or they may be in a position that would be very responsive to radiation therapy. So it really depends on all these variables. But even if your dog has had one seizure, it's time to have a good physical exam, neurologic exam, and some baseline blood work done, so that we have that information on the dog, and then we make a decision as to whether we need to start therapy or not.
There you go, Terry. Thank you very much for calling. Jan in Stevens Point has something for us. Jan, hello.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling, I'm wondering if Dr. Sawchuk could talk a little bit about Bordetella. We've had an outbreak here recently, and my dog was boarded 2 weeks ago in the place that it was having the outbreak. She did, of course, have the medication to try to prevent it before I took her out there. Anyway, symptoms and anything else, I understand there's more than one outbreak in the state. If she could talk a little bit about that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, the big issue is, was it really Bordetella? Bordetella goes by the name Bordetella bronchoseptica, which is very similar to a bug that humans get called Bordetella pertussis, or whooping cough. And so it's something that we do vaccinate dogs for, but it's one of multiple forms of respiratory infections that dogs may get. When we are thinking that a dog may have kennel cough due to Bordetella, we can treat that with an appropriate antibiotic. But there are many different viral forms. There's even mycoplasma. There's, you know, things like canine influenza that can cause coughing. And so unless you've done a respiratory pathogen screen or a culture of the respiratory secretions, you may be making a guess as to actually what is causing your dog to cough. So the fact that your dog was vaccinated, and I have to assume it was probably either with the nasal vaccine or the oral vaccine, because the injectable form of the vaccine doesn't work very well for Bordetella, it probably wasn't Bordetella. It was probably one of these other forms of the disease. And when we have a big outbreak, that typically tells us in the veterinary community, we better start doing some respiratory pathogen screening, which means sending in a pharyngeal swab to the state lab. And they do a printout, and it runs, I think, about $110. It's not inexpensive, but they're able to tell you what is the cause of the dog's coughing. I had a dog in recently that I thought for sure had influenza, and it turned out to be canine herpes virus. So, and that was something that we just have to ride it out. And the dog was in isolation until it got feeling better and then went home to finish out its convalescence. But so I don't know if your dog went through that kind of testing, but that would be what we would need to do to be able to determine if it was Bordetella.
Yeah, there you go, Jan. Thank you very much for calling. And Gary in Lime Springs, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a golden retriever, and he's about 13 years old, and a couple weeks ago he just kind of decided he didn't want to eat anymore. He's just like food's repulsive. He's lost a lot of weight, of course. He's had a bulge on his side near his left front leg for quite a while. So just don't know if it's something that he's just trying to tell me it's the time to start thinking the worst, or if there's something we can do.
Yeah, you know, it's golden retrievers are not known for being picky eaters. They typically are one of those breeds that eat all the time. And we often use appetite as one of our quality of life scales to see, you know, how is the dog doing? And you know, we look at other things as well, mobility and pain and you know, are they enjoying life? Have they accidents and so on in the house? But lack of appetite is a symptom of many different things. It could be from pain. It could be he could be nauseated because he's got chronic renal disease. I just had a dog in this week that has had a decreased appetite, same type of thing, never really missed a meal, but now he's only eating if it's kind of hand-fed or pampered. And he's in end-stage kidney failure, and we wouldn't have known it. The owner didn't recognize the fact that the dog was drinking more, urinating more, but we found it on blood work. So if you need questions to be able to help you with making that decision as to what to do for your dog and whether to say, you know, it's been a good run, is maybe taking them in to have a veterinarian have a look, get a physical exam done. Sometimes on physical exam, we can find things like big lymph nodes or an abdominal mass that may be, you know, giving your dog some problems. So we may find something on physical exam that could be leading us down that cancer path. I'm going through all kind of the things that would normally be the difficult decision, hard to treat things. But other things that we can see are things like, does your dog have a GI foreign body or something that's making them feel really nauseated? And again, that may take imaging to be able to get a diagnosis of that. And again, I don't know if you're at that point where that kind of investment is what you would like to make in your dog, but I think it's always worthwhile to have some of those basic answers before you make that end-of-life choice.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. It's such a tough point to be in when they get to be that age where you're thinking, you know, do we have more time with them or not? And it sometimes is a little bit of a gamble.
Thank you, Gary, very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You can email your questions and maybe send a photo to ideas@wpr.org, or you can phone us at 800-642-1234. And speaking of email photos, Sherry emailed a photo of her pup who's named Rocky. What a handsome animal.
Yeah, it looks like a beautiful, well-groomed schnauzer. What I like to see in the photo, though, is the fact that the dog has a seatbelt on. He's got a comfortable bed, and he's got a harness on that looks like it's attached to the seatbelt, which is going to be a great way to protect your dog. If you ever have to slam the brakes on fast, they're usually the things that go flying, and we want to make sure that we're safe and our pets are safe when we're traveling with our pets.
So a really cool photo here. Let's see if I can get back to our callers. Martha is up next, I believe. Martha, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. You know, since the end of June, our 13-and-a-half-year-old Labrador Retriever, she's a British lab, seems to be sudden issues with pancreatitis. And I'm curious, is it really onset that fast where they come up with those symptoms?
It can. And sometimes we'll see pancreatitis associated with things like they got into a fatty meal or ate something that they shouldn't have. Sometimes even certain medications can cause irritation to the intestines and pancreas. And I don't know how your dog's been diagnosed. There is a blood test that looks at markers for pancreatitis that if that came back positive and your dog is not super uncomfortable, is still able to eat, they're often just supportive care with pain medication, a bland, low-fat diet to kind of give the pancreas a little bit of rest to kind of get them through that. But if there's questions about, you know, what may be causing this, being an older dog, we worry about things that could be obstructing ducts and causing problems, infiltrative diseases. So getting a cranial abdominal ultrasound done would be probably your best imaging modality to be able to get some answers as to what may be going on. So I hope that it is a painful condition in dogs. Cats, different story. Cats get pancreatitis and it's chronic and kind of low grade. And it's just a different animal, different species handles it differently, but it can be very severe and even life-threatening in dogs, all different extremes. So again, get your dog some help if they're that uncomfortable.
And thanks, Martha, very much for calling. Jeff in Altoona, let's go to you now. Hi.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What I have is I've got a 4-year-old mix Bichon / Jack Russell Terrier. Very healthy, very active, and was just at the vet probably 3 weeks ago for shots. And I was kind of trimming him up and grooming him the other day, and I noticed that there was a down kind of lower belly, kind of down towards the groin, there's just like a red circle. It's not a spot. It's just one single red circle, and I don't know if the vet missed it or if, if it just developed, but just kind of curious what it might be and what next steps I should take.
Most of the time when we see these circular areas on a dog's lower abdomen, the most common thing is the beginning of a staph infection or a bacterial skin infection. They can come up very, very quickly. They start as a small, like raised red bump that turned into a pimple and very quickly rupture and then develop this kind of red circular patch. And the way we diagnose whether it is a bacterial infection is we'll take a glass slide and do an impression smear of the area and have a look to see what's there. There are other things that can cause spots on the lower abdomen. I mean, oddball things like, did your dog have a bruise from some type of a bleeding disorder? Did they get an insect bite? There could be other things that could be triggering this as well. But having a good look, maybe there's other ones that are in the hair around that area. So really getting a good look. When I'm looking at a dog's for skin infections, it usually means I'm down on the floor with them. They're rolled over, legs are spread, and we're spreading the fur and having a good look up in the armpits and, you know, everywhere up and down the thighs and so on, so we can see the extent of what the problem is. If this is a skin infection, it's just a single spot, this would be a perfect thing to be considering topical therapy. Chlorhexidine-based shampoos, mousses, sprays are often enough to be able to get this under control. If you are aggressive with using it every day for usually a couple of weeks, we'll get things knocked out.
There you go, Jeff. Thank you for calling. Russ in Stoughton may have something kind of similar. Let's go there. Russ, hi.
Hi, good morning. I had a couple of questions. I had just got in tune to the program just as your guest was saying, talking about dogs with allergies and that it gets worse every year. And she was saying something to do with that there are better things than steroids now, a new kind of medicine. I have a 6.5-year-old Shiba Inu that was diagnosed with the allergy about 4 years ago, and he has been on prednisone, but they don't seem to be having the effect. And the vet said, well, if this isn't working, we can move on to steroids. I think your guest mentioned that there was something better than steroids. I missed what that medicine was.
Yeah, prednisone is a steroid, and way back in, you know, years ago, that was something that we would grab and use just for that acute for a few days to kind of put the flare out. But that has side effects that can affect the liver, the skin thickness, their immune system. And so I don't like using steroids chronically. Even topical use long term can cause some issues with skin thinning and recurrent infections and so on. So I usually like to use something that's more targeted at the immune system. And that would be using a drug called Apoquil. It's an oral tablet that works on many of the mediators of the allergy system. There's one that's very directed at the allergy mediators. It's called Cytopoint. That's an injectable, almost like a vaccine that you use every 4 weeks to 8 weeks, depending on the dog. There's also drugs that are called cyclosporine. Atopica is another one that's kind of getting to be not as popular as the first two drugs that I mentioned. But those should be things that your veterinarian should have access to and be able to offer you to give your dog some comfort with very little side effects compared to, instead of using steroids. So I hope that your dog can get some comfort, because allergies are no fun. Your dog keeps you awake. They make themselves irritated. And the big thing is, we want your dog to be comfortable.
And Russ, you had a question about a kitten as well?
Oh, yes. I adopted a kitten because about 6 months ago in March, it was about 6 months old. It's very typical tabby, very loving and all that. And all. But what it does is, I don't understand this, and I'm never around to see it. It seems to tip over its water bowl along with the dog's water bowl. And I got a really heavy thing from the store that I didn't think it could tip over, but I'll get up in the morning and there it is. The water is flat. Is this a typical cat thing, and why would it do that?
A lot of cats will play in water and do this, and I don't know why, but they'll splash in it. I have a cat that I put his water dish on top of some paper towels, and it's always wet. You know, it's like, what are you doing? You know, you're digging in it, or what are you doing? Or playing in it. So they do make non-spill water dishes. They're primarily designed for dogs, but if you just Google that, you'll be able to find they're a specially designed dish that it's almost like the sippy cups for kids that don't allow it to spill when the cup goes upside down. It's like that, but the dog and the cat can get their head in it and they're able to drink from it. But when it gets tipped, it's not going to keep your cat from digging in the water and maybe splashing it out, but they won't be able to tip it over, because even if it ends up on its side or upside down, the reservoir holds the existing water so that it stays in the bowl and you don't have cleanup to do the next morning.
There you go, Russ. Thank you for calling. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, they make those. Cool. I bought one for my dogs, thinking it was going to be big enough, but I have English bulldogs. They can't get their face in it. It was a small enough hole, so you have to know the breed of your dog and really evaluate the specifics on the dishes before you go out and buy them and bring them home. I ended up gifting it to somebody else, but I thought it'd be perfect when we're in the RV because, you know, if we are, you know, driving and hitting rough roads, it can splash around and we don't have to worry about it overflowing. But no, it didn't work. So I'm back to using an old heavy weighted bowl again. Yeah.
On to Leslie in Elgin, Illinois. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Larry, Dr. Sashek. My question is, I have a 13-year-old cat that has a squamous cell carcinoma on his lower lip, and I don't really want to do surgery if I can help it, because they would have to take so much. I'm afraid he won't be able to eat or have quality of life. I'm trying to use a Miclamod cream. Have you heard of anything, and anyone having any good luck with that?
Well, that is often used for things like basal cell tumors and things in people, and it's a topical chemotherapy agent. My concern would be the cat's going to lick it off. It's not designed to be taken orally. And because of the location, using that type of cream in that area could potentially be a problem. If it's outside the lip and not involving the mouth, and it's more on the face or the chin, potentially you could get by with using it. But that is usually used for more superficial type cancers, if I'm being correct. And, yeah. and often squamous cell is very invasive, and you do have to take wide surgical margins to be able to get it under control. Has your veterinarian talked to you at all about radiation therapy?
Well, we've talked about it. I just don't want to put him through a lot of treatment to end up in the same place in
right.
the end.
Do
you know what I mean?
It's a horrible kind of cancer for cats to have, and I wish there were better alternatives, but there really, really isn't. And I'm so sorry. The big thing is make sure your cat's on pain medication, and keeping your cat comfortable is the probably the big thing you can do right now. Quality of life.
Mm. Sorry, Leslie. Thank you for calling. Joe in Appleton will give you a chance. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I have a 2-year-old cat, and I need to take her to my cottage on the lake, and it's a 50-minute trip. But 40 minutes into the trip, she tends to show signs of throwing up or gagging or something, and I hate to see her. Once she gets there, she's fine. But I hate to see her like that, and I'm wondering if that kind of repetitive throwing up is harmful to the cat.
Yes. Is it a cat that you're dealing with? If they're getting nauseated, you definitely want to be looking at getting this kitty on some type of anti-nausea medication. And there are oral anti-nausea medications available, even over-the-counter medications that are very effective as well, that you may be able to get, like the Bonine type things or Dramamine that you could potentially use in your kitty. But talk to your veterinarian. A prescription drug may be helpful.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. She will be with us up until 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Lots of calls and questions, Sandy. Betty emailed asking what can be done about dogs being imported that are bringing in disease. Should these dogs be quarantined?
Yeah, that's a big issue. You know, even dogs within our country, not even being imported from other countries, can bring diseases from other parts of our country up here. And for instance, we see a lot of dogs coming from down south that are coming up with heartworm disease because there's such a delay from them being exposed to the infective mosquito. And when we can get a positive test, they may be tested down there and say, yep, your blood test came back negative for heartworm, but they may be incubating it. And so we get them up here. Meanwhile, our mosquito population gets infected and we have a dog with heartworm living in our area. So it's a kind of a touchy spot for we want to see dogs get adopted, and we definitely have a higher adoption rate in this part of the country compared to other parts of the country or other countries in general. I think we need to be really careful regarding all these diseases. And now with other foreign diseases, there was just in the last year or two a group of dogs that were imported from somewhere in the Middle East that all had rabies, and they had to go through finding who had had contact and finding all these dogs and all the people that had contact with these dogs. And, you know, it's, you know, something like that that we have vaccines for, that we really work on trying to prevent. We brought it into the country and exposed a lot of people to. So, yeah, I think it's a good idea. Is it done? Not necessarily. So, yeah.
Emily emailed as well. Her 5-year-old, 80-pound Alaskan Malamute ate some raisins. Not sure how many, but she only put a half a small container on the toddler's plate to begin with. This happened yesterday. The dog seems fine. Should she be concerned?
Yes. And this is the big problem with raisins, is we don't know there are some dogs that can eat them willy-nilly and never get sick, but then there's other dogs that will go into renal failure, and it can be very acute and fatal. There was, you know, even, you know, just a very small number of raisins can potentially be toxic, and it does not appear to be number or size dependent. And so it's not like, well, there was only half a box there, I don't, and my dog weighs 80 pounds. That could be enough to cause your dog to have kidney disease. And dogs look fine, and they usually don't start showing symptoms for a couple of days. And so when we have a dog that ingests raisins, the first thing we do is try to get them to vomit, to get them out of their system. It's now been 24 hours too late for your dog to induce vomiting, but we will put these dogs on IV fluids and diurese them to try to keep that fluid going through the kidneys to keep the, you know, keep their kidneys flushed out for, you know, often 24 to 48 hours of being in the hospital to have that done. So I'd be taking your dog in, bring a urine sample with you. They're probably going to want to do some blood work, and they may be recommending that your dog stay in the hospital. That would be, I'd look at the minimum of care for your dog.
Ginny in Verona, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good to listen to you guys. You're always so informative. I have two kitties. Ricky is the one that I'm asking the question about. He's about two and a half years old. And in April, he vomited so hard that it affected his vagal nerve, and he was wobbling all over the place, so we got that cleared up. A week or so ago, he was throwing up after eating, and so it turned out, we did x-rays, it turned out his anal glands were full, and the x-rays showed that he had a lot of fecal matter in his colon, and we're assuming he wasn't pooping because it hurt. So once they took care of the anal glands, he went back to normal very quickly. But he still throws up small amounts of hair, sometimes three times a day. He's happy.
Wow.
He's healthy. He eats.
Yeah.
I can't find anything else wrong with him. I've changed his diet so that he just has only one type of raw for, you know, I've just started this, like he'll have chicken raw and freeze-dried chicken, and just water. I've left everything out. The oils, the probiotics, I've left everything out.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's very happy. And I brush them with a slicker brush every day because his sister Lucy, she sheds like a horse.
Yeah, I think hairballs are given a bad rap, and it's normal for cats to vomit hair up once in a while, and I'll usually give cats two or three passes a year where if they vomit and there's a large amount of hair in the vomitus, it was probably due to the hair. But, you know, if your cat is vomiting that much, my guess is that the hair is just going along for the ride. Cats groom naturally, so there's going to be a little bit of hair in their stomach, and they can be vomiting for a totally different reason than the hairballs that may be coming up. And the fact that your cat is vomiting that many times a day, this warrants more evaluation. And I'd be looking at considering, you know, when it comes to diet, your cat is on a very unbalanced diet, being on a raw or even freeze-dried just chicken diet. That is not enough to be able to support your cat long term. And he's a young cat. You know, often if we're looking at, if you're, you know, not considering diagnostics, and diagnostics for a cat with this kind of vomiting would be minimum database with some blood work, including a blood cell count. And I'd also be looking at probably getting some imaging done to be able to look at thickness of the intestines, the pancreas, the stomach, and so on. And then even considering scoping and biopsying to be able to get some answers. But if you are looking at, well, we want to just try him on something, I'd be saying a hydrolyzed protein diet that his body is not going to recognize where that food has come from, like what type of protein it is. chicken is one of the big offenders for cats in causing food allergies, and that can result in them having chronic GI inflammation and vomiting. So there's something serious going on with your cat, and I don't think just playing with the diet is going to be enough. It's time to go back in either to your veterinarian or to an internist that specializes in GI disease so that we can get some answers for your young cats so that they're not spending the rest of their life having these kind of issues, because he's happy and healthy right now, but that doesn't mean he's going to stay that way.
Yeah. Good luck, Jenny. Thank you. Matt in Fitchburg, thank you for calling. Oh, we lost Matt. Let's go to Dennis in St. Germain. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, we have a 10-year-old Maine Coon male cat, and he was recently diagnosed with kidney problem, kind of early onset, not early for his age, but just beginning of the kidney disease.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a very fussy eater. He's always been fussy. And he will just not eat the kidney diet food that's commercially available.
That's a tough one. Yeah, yeah. So when we have cats with kidney disease, we do grade it on a scale of 1 to 4, with 1 being the earliest and 4 being the most advanced. And things that you can do early on is really making sure that your cat has water, 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 so they don't ever get dehydrated and stress those kidneys ever even more. We like to try to introduce renal diets, and there are more than one of them out there on the market. And some cats like stews, some like pâtés, some like certain dry foods. And when we initially diagnose a cat with kidney disease, one of the things we like to do is before they start feeling sick is trying to find a diet that they'll switch over to that they may like. What's special about kidney diets for cats is that they tend to be lower in protein, so it takes some of the stress off of the kidneys from having to deal with nitrogenous waste. They're higher in potassium because cats tend to waste potassium through their urine when they're making more dilute urine as their kidneys fail. And it's usually lower in phosphorus. And that's where the different kidney diets, there's some that are early kidney diet and some that are more advanced kidney diet. They typically have different phosphorus levels to meet the needs of the kitty. Starting your cat on, trying one of these diets and see if your veterinarian could get you some samples of different diets. It's not just the science diet. There's Nestle Purina has one. Royal Canin has renal diets out. There's Blue Buffalo has some prescription diets out. So there's a number of them out there that you can try for your cat. And it's a matter of trying to find that one that your cat would like. And hopefully you'll hit the right one. And that's going to give your cat longer quality of life, a better quality of life for a longer period of time.
For sure. Dennis, thank you for calling. Cindy in Eau Claire, we'll go to you next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Say, my daughter is getting married next month, and her fiance is allergic to her cat. So we're just wondering if there might be someone recommended baths. May work, but she seems to think he'll freak out.
Yeah, most cats don't see the humor in being bathed. And a couple of things I would recommend. Because we spend a quarter plus of our life, a third of our life in the bedroom, have that be a cat-free zone where the cat is not allowed in there so that her future husband has a safe area that he can go and hang around in. Look at not if they're in the market for buying new furniture, going with leather furniture or vinyl furniture, something that can be wiped down rather than upholstery. Same thing for curtains, using vertical blinds rather than horizontal that are going to hold dust and actually hold some of those cat dander and things that's released from the cat. And you're right, with grooming the cat frequently and even damp mopping them is going to help with eliminating some of that allergen that's on the surface of the cat's body. It doesn't have to be a full bath. We found that just using baby wipes, or there are allergy-specific kind of coat conditioning wipes that you can get for cats. Those are very helpful to just daily give the cat kind of a wipe down besides the regular grooming to keep the hair under control. Installing a HEPA filter, using a HEPA filter vacuum, getting rid of carpets and having more easily clean flooring. That should make the household a lot nicer for your husband. And there is some work now where there's a new vaccine that's come out that are not, it's not available yet, but there's research being done that is given to the cat to help decrease the production of FeLD1, which is the allergen that cats release. So new one. I don't know anything about it. It's been something that I just kind of saw in a little brief news release. So
what could the future husband, is there anything the future husband could take?
Well, he could talk to his allergist, a non-sedating antihistamine, so that he can lead a normal life, going through allergy injections. I don't know whether they do sublingual therapy for people now, but that would be something that I know that you can get allergy injections to develop a tolerance to the cat allergen if they want to go through that. But again, that doesn't work overnight, and they are going to have to come up with something fairly quickly to be able to allow him to be comfortable with living in a household with the cat.
Terry emailed, they always had their dog spayed or neutered at 6 months. The breeder for the dog they just got, 9-month-old female boxer, recommend they delay spaying until 18 to 24 months because it could possibly prevent ACL injuries in the future. Since two of their female boxers had ACL injuries requiring surgery, they're considering the breeder's recommendation. Any research to back this up?
Yes, and unfortunately, it's been limited on certain breeds of dogs, but it appears that it's, you know, if this was a male dog, I would say no brainer. If you can, if the dog is a, you know, having him neutered later, if behaviorally they can, they're not getting into trouble with fighting with other boy dogs, lifting his leg and so on, some of the male behaviors that are troublesome when they are intact, then letting them go as long as possible, knowing that you have to be a good dog owner and not let your dog go to doggy daycare, dog parks or anything, because we don't want them to impregnate another dog. Female dogs, different story. We have them come into heat, and you're going to have to live through a couple of heat cycles. And once they've been through a couple of heat cycles, the damage has been done to the mammary tissue, and this dog could potentially develop breast cancer down the road. So it's one of those balancing acts of when to do it. Typically what we're doing for female dogs is saying maybe one heat cycle if you can keep them from getting impregnated. Obviously, you have to be a good owner and keep them away from other dogs during this time. Know how to deal with a dog that's in heat and the mess and so on that's involved. But getting them spayed as soon as after a year of age as possible. So it's kind of that happy medium where we're allowing the dog to reach physical sort of maturity. Some dogs don't reach maturity until they're like much bigger. But I think with a boxer, if you could wait until over a year of age, knowing the risk benefit, I think that that would be helpful. But again, if anybody from the Humane Society is listening, they're probably going, oh my God, get them spayed or neutered, you know, as a juvenile, because their goal is to prevent births. My goal is to try to keep your dog healthy. And I think that's a, you know, that's a nice happy medium of not doing it when they're little puppies, but not quite waiting as long as what the breeder would like.
Julie in Mondovi, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a Yorkie that is a Yorkie Terrier that's 10 years old and weighs 8 pounds. And about a month and a half ago, he developed where he was starting to limp on his front left side. So we took him to the vet, and the vet examined him. There's nothing wrong with his leg itself. There's no pain or anything, but he won't put the paw down. He does have substantial muscle loss in the shoulder, and he did have an accident at a kennel about 5 years ago where they said they had dropped him, and it was quite severe. Although he didn't show any symptoms of that, but he did have some nerve damage on the side of his face and his jaw area. The vet thought possibly there is some nerve damage, and he's just not putting it down because he can't tell, you know, the feeling-wise. But he does have the pain in the shoulder, and so they prescribed meloxicam for him, today. It doesn't, and he did give him a steroid injection at the time of the exam, and it didn't. He said it should, you know, we should see the improvement probably within a week, which he didn't have any improvement. He's still limping around. It doesn't seem to bother him too much to just limp around on his three legs, but, you know, we're just wondering if there's any other medication.
Yeah. What I'm really concerned about is what you're describing could be not a limb problem, but more of a neck problem or what's called a brachial plexus problem, the nerves going to the leg. The muscle atrophy, because of disuse, is possible. But if you're seeing kind of very quick muscle atrophy, I'd be really worried about some type of a nerve disorder. And when we see this, it can be they can have nerve pain going down the leg, which causes them to hold the leg up and be uncomfortable. I don't know if your veterinarian has, you know, evaluated up in the armpit area, like getting way up there to see if they can feel any masses, or getting some imaging done of the lower neck area to see if there's a disc or something there that could be causing some compression and affecting the nerves going to that leg. That's where I would be going. I'm concerned about the fact that your veterinarian mixed a corticosteroid with meloxicam. Putting those two things together, even if one's given by injection and the other's given orally, can result in severe gastric ulceration. So we have to, if we've had a dog on steroids, they have to be off of steroids before we can put them on meloxicam. So, you know, meloxicam only does so much. It's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. If you wanted to try switching to a different one, you would need to have a few days washout period, and then you can try a different type of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. But I don't know if it's going to make that much difference. Sometimes adding in another type of pain medication, there's one that's more specific, I should say, for neuropathic pain, and it goes by the name of gabapentin. It's a very common human medication that is available in tableted form and capsules. It's also available in a liquid form, but we have to be really careful with dogs because the human liquid gabapentin is mixed with xylitol, which brings us back to how I started the show talking about xylitol toxicity. Here we'd be trying to help your dog, and if we wrote a prescription for liquid gabapentin, that could potentially kill your dog by causing xylitol toxicity. So, knowing if you're writing an outside prescription, a lot of human pharmacists don't know that, and so it could get through, and your dog could get sick. So, but looking at maybe adding in some gabapentin may make your dog feel a lot more comfortable, and hopefully you can get some answers because I hate to see your dog in pain like this.
Yeah, thank you, Julie. We have had some emails about dog food, one from Scott in Mequon, wondering about taurine in dog food minimum percentages. And you mentioned a website on the last show.
I did. And it's an easy one to remember. It's taurine, the name of the amino acid, T-A-U-R-I-N-E, and then the heart disease that it causes, DCM, dilatedcardiomyopathy.org. That is one of those sites that has a multitude of information, taurinedcm.org, not only how to choose pet foods and what to be looking at in dog foods, because it's not just taurine. It's some of these boutique diets. It may be exotic ingredients. It may be the company that's making it that is, you know, their manufacturing process if they're not doing food trials afterwards. But it's a great resource with all the information from many of the schools that have nutritionists on staff to the FDA. It's, you know, updates as we know what's going on, because right now we're still a little bit up in the air. Get your dog off of grain-free. Get your dog on a diet that is going through feeding trials. It's made by a company that there's only four in the nation that I know of, and that would be Purina, Hills or Science Diet, Royal Canin, or Eukanuba. Those are the only three that meet all the criteria that many nutritionists, including myself, and I'm not a nutritionist, have for choosing a pet food. So go there, and hopefully that'll provide some assistance and we can keep our dogs healthy.
Dr. Sandy, you will be back September 24th.
I will.
Thank you so much for today. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back September 24th. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the upcoming Quilt Expo and learn about wildlife photography as well. That's Wednesday. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.